Hey everybody, it's Rick Hansen from Cheap Trick. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
Yes, we certainly are, Rick. And hey everyone, it's Nate here. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we are talking with none other than Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, who many of you know is an avid collector of many things, most famously guitars, but Rick also collects stamps, coins, and yes, even vinyl records. Today we talk to Rick about his extensive collecting hobbies, what it means to him to be a collector, some of the amazing stuff he's amassed over the years, from a Jimi Hendrix guitar to approximately 5,000 airplane boarding passes. That's right, Rick hangs on to a lot of stuff. And today, Rick also shares about his relationship with bands like AC/DC and members of the Beatles. He recalls how Frank Zappa once offered him a recording contract. He discusses the night he told a crowd waiting to see Otis Redding that their hero was in a plane crash. He shares many guitar stories. He also talks about the history of Cheap Trick live at Budokan and heaps more. We cover a lot of ground today. Now, I don't know if you're aware, but there are some very special dates coming up, including the new Cheap Trick album, In Another World, due out April 9th. And you could, of course, hear a few songs right now on any streaming service and be ready for when the full album can be downloaded on April 9th. Now, of course, vinyl is available too at cheaptrick.com. And one other date to put in your calendar is Thursday, April 1st. That is Cheap Trick Day. And yes, that is an official thing. The state of Illinois passed a legislation making every April 1st Cheap Trick Day. And of course, that's celebrated not only in Illinois, but all around the world as well. Now, you could celebrate Cheap Trick Day by heading over to ricknielsen.com and ordering some autographed vinyl and, of course, blasting Cheap Trick on that day. So that's Thursday, April 1st, International Cheap Trick Day, as well as April 9th, the new Cheap Trick album, In Another World. And by the way, what you're hearing today on this feed is only part of the discussion. Rick and I had a much longer interview, which we've made available only to patrons of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide, as well as a full video of the interview with Rick. Again, only available to the patreon.com/vinylguide community. Go there now, sign up, get access to exclusive content, extended interviews, secret episodes, now a super special video, and you get to help support the show and keep us going. It's just a couple bucks per month, puts a couple burritos in my stomach, and it helps me keep churning out these episodes. Sign up now at patreon.com/vinylguide and hear the rest of the show. All right, we're all strapped in and ready to go. Let's talk to the king of collectors, Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick.
Rick, how are you today?
For you, Nate.
Look, there's a lot to talk about. I want to talk to you a little bit about collecting. Because This podcast, we talk to record collectors, vinyl collectors, people who have music collections. And you're a collector, obviously. Lots of guitars, lots of pins and badges and things. I would imagine you have a record collection as well. Is that right?
I do. The stuff that I have the most of, my record collection, were English albums, the shiny LP stuff, like the first Hendrix record with the no bra on. I have a lot of bands that I like, to Boxer, Pado, a lot of different stuff that I have. I have the English versions of it, and I have the 45s back then that has the little disc in the middle of it of my early Small Faces stuff, and that's the stuff that I have. I kind of quit collecting records. I mean, I still have some, but it's like not as many. And the vinyl I have, I think when I moved between houses, like, I don't even know where the turntable went. So now I just refound it again.
Okay.
But I'm never home enough to have used it either. So it's like, there's so much going on. I mean, it's like, I'm doing book stuff. I'm doing collecting and stuff. Mm-hmm. I still have my coin collection.
Yeah,
and I started back in the '60s, probably late '50s.
Wow.
And yeah, not many. But my grandmother collected blocks of four stamps, and then the blocks of four means you had the corner, all four, and it had the serial number on it. And so I used to get that. So I have all the stuff up until I think about 63 or something like that.
Now, are you still adding things to your collections?
Which collection?
Well, let's say records and guitars. How about those?
Well, some records I do. I mean, I've got I got the Beatles live at the Budokan. Somebody had me, and I think it was from Korea or some place. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. I collected coins too, and I still do occasionally because I just like the designs on that stuff. I mean, I have every proof set from 1948 to now.
Wow.
And I got them. Actually, I had some stuff from Australia too that I got the Australian. I'll look it up. I never thought about it until now. I got them for each of my kids, mm-hmm. like proof sets from like the first tour over there. Wow. And just recently I've got a whole bunch of some Liberty, early Liberty silver dollars, mm-hmm. and half dollars. I just love the design of that stuff.
Wow. Do you go to things like coin shows or anything? Are you interested to that level?
Well,
or
I do occasionally go to places that have that kind of stuff. Like Buffalo Nickels. And also, if you know anything about the States, they had a number of years ago, they started having dollars of every state. Mm-hmm. So you had to buy a brick of them. And you had to buy 1,000 of each one. So I got Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Adams, Jackson, Van Buren, Harrison, Tyler, Polk, Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce Buchanan, Lincoln, Johnson, Gray. You know, so I got the presidents in order. And it's like, because it's harder to, you don't want to take them out and sell them. Right. Two, if you have some paper money, that just goes too quick. And they weigh a lot, and so they're hard to do it. Mm. And even my own grandkids don't think it's a great thing.
Well, when you come down to Australia, we're going to have to connect you up with some of these. These are AC/DC coins that they have from the Australian Mint down here.
Wow. Yeah.
So we'll need to fill your pockets of those.
Oh, yeah. I went to AC/DC Street.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In Melbourne.
Yeah, yeah.
If memory serves me right, you even shared the stage with Bon Scott at one point. Is that right?
Yeah, there's actually a track of us doing Johnny B. Goode together. It was Bon and it was Malcolm and Angus.
Mm-hmm. How did that come together? Do you remember?
We were playing a show. We did a lot of flip-flop shows. You know, mm-hmm. we were both equally unknown, but we were both building an audience. And so it was like we played together. One night we closed, some night they closed. You know, they were like the ultimate band. I mean, I watched every show they did. You know, it was like, you know, I love Phil. You know, later down the road, I took Bon to his first taco he ever had, taco and scotch. I had Angus and Malcolm and Cliff come to my house. And then I took them over to the house that I'd bought that I was going to fix up. You know, I had an apartment, you know, a second floor place. But I'd bought it at their house because I always like architecture. It was a 10,000 square foot house built in 1854. And, you know, I liked all the stuff that went along with it. You know, I said, I got a place on the National Register of Historic Homes. And, you know, it's like, I'm kind of a geek that way, but it's like, but it was a wreck when I bought it. But I took them over there and we drove through while they were doing it. And then when I saw the last tour that the Malcolm was on, and mm-hmm. I was the only guy backstage with all these country stars down in Nashville. Mm-hmm. He didn't let anybody in, but they let me in. His first thing is, like, hey, Rick, you still living in Rockford? Yeah, okay. You know, it's like, and then I saw Angus at a restaurant in L.A. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, we were kind of just kind of goofy friends. I mean, I was a goof and he was a goof. And it's like, but we both liked what we were doing. And we got along well when we toured. I think they went on to do something pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I loved the band. It's like, and, you know, so... And the day that the house that I'm telling you about, mm-hmm. the day that Bon Scott died, I had a fire at that house when I was in Montserrat making an album. And, you know, I cared more about Bon Scott, of course. But I have a lyric in there in the song, Love Comes a Tumbling Down, same day.
Wow. So that lyric was inspired by Bon.
Yeah,
You're thinking of Bon that day.
Yeah.
Amazing. Now, you've had such a rich and colorful history. You clearly worship at the Church of the Beatles. And at one point, you even played with John Lennon during the Double Fantasy sessions. Was that your first time meeting a Beatle?
Well, yeah. But Yeah, but no. Okay. It was before that. It was 1980. It was like right after we recorded in Montserrat. We were George Martin. We went back to England to went to England from Montserrat. We did the basic tracks there, and then we flew over to England and went to Air Studios in London. And Paul McCartney was coming to take George for dinner, and here we are in the studio. I was like, "Oh, have him come out." Well, it was raining, so Paul didn't want to get out. So George went down, but then Leif Garrett came.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. But Brian May came too. Or it's like, yeah, it's like it was good stuff when we were there. And mm-hmm. you know, since then, after that, then I worked with George Martin. And it's like mm-hmm. and I went to his house. He cooked for me. And Giles, who I knew from earlier, because he had my picks and drumsticks. And then I was invited to go to a George Martin memorial service. So my wife and I flew over, and we sat in about the fourth or fifth row. Mm-hmm. It's like, here's Pink Floyd, and here's Genesis, and here's Phil Collins, and here's Elvis Costello. They're all behind us. And here I'm over, you know, I'm the guy from Rockford, Illinois. And it's like, so as we're filing out, I stopped and talked with Sean and Julian and Yoko. And I worked with Yoko another time too. But as we're just talking, chit-chatting about them, and all of a sudden, a guy comes over to me and says, "Hello, Rick." I said, "Hello, Paul." And he came over and said, you know, I knew he was there, but I didn't know he knew, mm-hmm. cared about me. And I said, "Is it raining out, Paul?" No, I didn't say that to him. But the left-handed Les Paul that he plays was from me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
How did that wind up in his hands?
Well, I said in, I think it was Guitar Player magazine or something, I've got this beautiful, you know, I collect guitars, so people knew about that. But it's like I said, I've got this beautiful left-handed Les Paul. I got it because it's beautiful and it's a work of art, blah, blah, blah. It didn't make many of them. We thought there was only four. I think there were six actually made in 58, 59, 60. Mm-hmm. And I said, but it should be in Paul McCartney or somebody that this is great, you know, and it doesn't need to be in my closet where, you know, never sees the light of day. And plus, I wouldn't know how to do it. Well, then we ended up making a deal.
Oh,
and that's his favorite guitar. I've got a clip about that too.
You get your phone rang. Oh, hey, Rick, I heard you said that.
Yeah, well, you know, the second Les Paul that Jeff Beck had was from me. He got in 1968.
Wow,
I was a guitar collector back then. It was a fluke how it happened. I was at the place where his roadie dropped his guitar and broke the head off, and he didn't even know about it. Jeff didn't. I've mm-hmm. been a fan since the Yardbirds. I went to the very first show of 19, you know, I saw the Yardbirds at Rock River Roller Rink. yeah, it was the first show. So I have this history of just being this geeky little kid running around that liked guitars. Mm-hmm. You know, and I bought my first Les Paul in 1955. I bought it in 1965 for $65. And I still have it. So don't make up this story.
Now, you've also got a Jimi Hendrix guitar, is that correct?
Yes, I do. I have a Stratocaster that he didn't smash or set on fire. It was like, I think it was 67. He was playing at the place called the Factory, mm-hmm. which was 315 West Gorham in Madison, Wisconsin, which ended up to be our office for 25 years. But I saw Hendrix there with a soft machine. So it was two shows for $3.50. But I got in. Because that was my manager. And then I was at another show. It was the Grim Reapers. That was the name of the band. Mm-hmm. And it was Otis Redding, the Barcase, and the Grim Reapers. And that was the night he crashed into Lake Monona and died. Oh. Yeah. So I'm on that poster. And I had to announce to the crowd that Otis wouldn't be appearing.
Okay. So let's talk about it. You get a phone call. Your manager comes up to you and gives you that sort of news. Is that?
Well,
what do you recall about that evening?
Well, we were on the bill, you know, we were on the poster, and those posters, you know, they were free, and I put them up places. I kept a few of them, and then there was a TV show called Antique Roadshow, mm-hmm. and here we got this thing, and we're just running, blah blah blah. And, you know, they didn't know it was me. And so, you know, it's like $7,000 or $8,000. You know, so I have six of them in my parents' house that I got to clear out of my old room.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So you had to go to the crowd after you'd played and say, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, no, we didn't play. It was like they were waiting to come in because he crashed in the afternoon.
Okay.
So I had to go and say to the audience, Otis isn't playing here. I think, I can't remember. I think our manager made us play anyhow. It's like, hey, how you doing? What's new? Yeah, it was awful, you know, because we knew they were dead. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of history about that. But that was, again, at the same place, at the factory.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the Grim Reapers a little bit. Is Grim Reapers your first record, Hound Dog and Cruising for Burgers?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. It was on Smack Records. SMAK. And before that, too, because I had done it earlier this year, I did an interview with Dweezil Zappa. Mm. Well, we opened for Frank Zappa and the Mother's Invention. And they showed up, they pulled up to the place in Lake Geneva, where 3 weeks later I played with The Who there, the Grim Reapers did. Well, here we were, Frank Zappa showed up. They had two brown Rambler station wagons. That's how they got there. And they said, they liked our band. And he said, we're doing this label, it's Bizarre Records. Mm-hmm. And we had just signed to Epic. So we hadn't made a record yet, but so we just signed to Epic. So they thought we'd be good for Bizarre Records.
Yeah.
Same thing that Alice Cooper was on. Yeah.
Now this is Fuse, right? So the
No, this is the Grim Reapers.
Okay.
The Grim Reapers they changed their name to Fuse.
Okay. All right.
It was the
okay.
same band.
Okay. So that record in particular, Hound Dog Cruising for Burgers, you have a handful of those, I imagine.
Yeah, I do. Actually, the Hound Dog, we got that version from the band called Plastic Penny. Mm-hmm. Which was Elton John's drummer. I can't remember. I know who it is, but I can't think of it. But he was in that band Plastic Penny, which we didn't know at the time. And when I told him, is it Nigel?
Nigel Olsen, yeah.
Yep,
Nigel
yeah, Olsen. That was him. So then I met him later, and he was like, he liked our band. He came to see us at LA Forum or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, real nice dress. It's like, you know, like, I'd never met him. It's like, do you know that? What? You know, it's like, whoa, small world. So that was their version that we did of Hound Dog. And Hound Dog wasn't on the record. Mm-hmm. So then when we did Don't Be Cruel, we were the only band in the world that did an Elvis Presley song and got in the top five. Yeah.
Now, was that a private press? Is that something that, do you know how many of those were made?
Which one?
A Hound Dog.
Smack? On Smack?
Yes.
100? I don't, no idea.
Okay. It's highly collectible now. I'm just is from a yeah, in, I don't know. Record. Yeah. Yeah. It's about $500, I think, for if you could find one of those, if you're lucky enough.
Well, if you look over here, hang on a second. Uh-huh. Probably can't see it. Can you see that on the piano?
Yeah. What is that? Gold record of some sort.
Yeah. It's Fats Domino. Ain't it a shame?
Oh, okay.
In 79, we were playing at Salt Lake City at Salt Palace or something, one of those places. Mm-hmm. And this guy comes in backstage, shows us a gold record. He says, Fats loves your version. He wants you to have this. from the Live Budokan record. You know, we sold 3 million records. It's like, that's some fresh cash for him. And they back in 55, they only made two of them. Made one for the artist and one for, I think, the producer or whatever.
So that's the original one from 55?
Yeah, that's the original one.
Wow.
We drew straws on it. I just happened to have it in there because it's right next to my Jeff Beck book that I hadn't read. It cost me $500 to get that thing, and it's just too heavy to open.
Now, does it say on the tag to Fats Domino? Is that the that's one of his special ones?
Here, hold on.
Oh, brilliant. Oh.
Okay, for all this time, I'm going to lie to you. I'll just lie the rest of this thing. Hold on.
Oh, on the Imperial label as well. Oh, that's amazing.
Yes, ain't it a shame, too.
Oh, fantastic. Beautiful. That's
yeah.
That's a real treasure there.
Yeah, you're telling me. You know, I never looked it up though. I don't buy stuff. So I buy stuff because I like it. Mm-hmm. And I've been burned on stuff. It's just like, but at least I like it. You know, it's like that way. If you're buying art or something, it hopes to be a great investment, and it doesn't do well, it's like, well, you better like what it looks like anyhow.
Well, exactly. Well, we all love it for the music, but it's interesting digging into some of these super rare things like the Grim Reapers. It's a bit of a hunt. I think that's what a lot of record collectors like, is the hunt. Huh? What drives you to collect things?
Well, that's what it was for me. I mean, one of the guitars I have here. But it was 1963, Gil Merle Travis. They made three of them because they were $2,000 in 1963. Mm-hmm. So if you had, you know, if you had $2,000, you could buy a Ford Mustang or a Volkswagen. And why would you put Gil Merle Travis on your, if you had that kind of money, you put your own name on a guitar. But they never went into production. They only made three. And it's like the Merle Travis family has one. I have the second one. And the third one is owned by a rich guy in Long Island. Mm-hmm. But when I'd looked for 35 years, I never saw one really. But then I had seen one. It has maximum ornamentation. It's like beautiful. It's like the binding is amazing. I'd seen only black and white photos of it. And it was like, if I ever found one, well, I've been searching and asking all these people. Nobody ever knew anything about it. Finally, after about 5 years of me bugging George Gruen, who knows everything about guitars, and I've worked with him since the 60s, he said, oh, yeah, well, I didn't want to do this. I was going to repair this myself. It's upstairs. Go upstairs. It was smashed. It was all in pieces. The head had been broken off, and the neck had been broken off, and the headstock had been put into a fireplace, so you could see the burn marks on it. I said, how much do you want for it? Camden Hunt, he says, $5,000 or something, you know, which like you're out of your mind if you're paying that kind of money mm-hmm. to this. I said, I got him the cashier's check immediately before he changed his mind. So I knew what it was. They made three. And then now I had the guys at the Guild and Fender, two of the guys that had built it in 1963, redid it, put it all back, you know, working condition. It's beautiful. It's one of the rarest guitars in the world. Why did I do it? It cost me more to have it fixed than it did to buy it, but it's I put a value of $1 million on it. And I was offered that money by one of the head guys from Starbucks. And I said, forget it. It took me all this time. You know, if I needed the money, I'd sell it. But it was like, I finally got this piece. It's an unbelievable, rare piece.
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, people. The Vinyl Guide today is brought to you by the new Groove Washer G3 fluid. Yes, you heard right. Groove Washer has an even fancier record cleaning fluid for you record nerds they call the G3, as well as the GSR, Groove Washer Super Rinse Fluid. Of course, they have the traditional G2 fluid as well, and all these come in small quantities for record hobbyists, as well as large 32 and 64 ounce versions for hardcore record collectors and record stores. Go to groovewasher.com to learn more. Use discount code VINYLGUIDE10 to save when you check these out. That's the Groove Washer G2, G3, and GSR cleaning fluids available at groovewasher.com. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10. And we're also brought to you today by AudiophileUSA.com. Used records only in excellent and near mint shape. Over 42,000 titles to choose from at AudiophileUSA.com, and they are always restocking and finding more. Dig around the website, search by genre, record label, and artist. Dig deep and find the deals, as well as sign up to be alerted when a new batch becomes available. That's AudiophileUSA.com, the best used records, the cleanest condition, all shipped directly to your front door. That's AudiophileUSA.com.
Now we return to the program, already in progress. No
limits. I would imagine with your guitars, there are some guitars that are kind of your go-to guitars that are out there. Maybe you play them a couple hours a week even.
Yeah.
But then there are other guitars that you get, you play, you put them in the case, and you may not even pull them out for years or decades.
Yeah, that's all right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I've got enough to do this, and I did it because I like it. You know, I've got stuff that I paid $500 and it's probably worth $100. And I have other things that have paid $50 that's worth $50,000 if you find the right guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I bought my Explorers, I bought my first one in 76 from George Gruen. He was asking $4,000 for it. They only made 19 of them. I knew that, and it was like, I wanted, oh, it's so rare. So I didn't have the $4,000, so I traded him, you know, some Les Pauls and some Fender Stratocasters. Mm-hmm. And probably a little cash, and I got it. Then a couple years later, a guy that I also dealt with in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Larry Briggs, he had one. He was asking $6,000. He said he couldn't sell it. And I bought that, but I traded a bunch of Stratocasters. He said nobody would buy the Explorer He said, I could sell Stratocasters all day. And they were about $450 at the time. Mm. You know, now they're $20,000-$30,000 or whatever. But it's like, I got them because I liked them. You know, it's like I didn't have the money. And it's, but I took them out. It's like, now they're, oh, they're the rarest things on earth. The last one to sold, sold for $1,000,001.
Jeez.
Yeah, you know, it's like, well, it wasn't me. I mean, I wouldn't have bought it at that kind of price.
Yeah.
But it's like, it is cool. You do it for the cool factor. It's not cool that you're cool, but it's the fact it's like, and I don't lust after it. If my kids were sick or this, I've owned 2,000 instruments, so they've all gone somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. You followed your muse, and that really is, yeah. You know, throughout history, you got it because you wanted it. But now guitars and records and coins, they all have a bit of an understandable value. But you also go so far, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you have saved pretty much every airplane boarding pass.
I have over 5,000 of those.
Now,
why?
Let me ask you that. Why?
I don't know, but it was just, it showed where I went. I liked it. Mm-hmm. I still have, you know, when I sold the guitar to Jeff Beck, they called me after I'd seen this. 2 weeks later, they called me up, Rick, do you still have guitars? Yes. Here's Jeff Beck. Do you still have guitars? Yeah. Hold on. Here's a manager. Can you come and see us? I said, yeah, sure. Where are you? Philadelphia. So I got my friend and myself. We took 5 guitars on a plane. I still have the ticket. $21 to fly on a TWA. Why did I keep it? I don't know, but I did. And then since then, it's like I've got quite a few more. Mm-hmm. And it's like having one is kind of sweet or nice, having whatever. But I just kept doing it. It was like maybe obsessive whatever, maybe. And I came home one day from being on the road, and my wife had a dumpster out next to her garage because he was cleaning the garage, and I was like, oh yeah, she doesn't know what's where. And one luggage tag that was in the trash was from Fukuoka, F-U-K. Here's fuck on there, and you throw that out. I was like, Jesus, what else is, you know, it's like I kept it because it, you know, I don't know what it means, you know, it's like it's whatever, there's no value for it, but I kept it.
Now, can you recall the memories of all those things? Like if you picked up, I mean, obviously the Jeff Beck one is a pretty memorable one, but I mean, just some flight to Orlando or
probably
DC
not.
Or whatever. Probably. Okay.
You know, well, I could look it up or whatever, but it's like, you know, it's not worth it. But there are certain ones. Of course they are. You know, I've got the Northwest Orient tickets when we flew in 1978 to go to when we played at Budokan. Mm-hmm. Here we're in the back. We're in the coach seat in the back, mm-hmm. waiting to go to our hotel where it was Tom and I stayed in one room. Robin and Bunny stayed in one room. We didn't even have our own rooms. Mm-hmm. No, wait a second. It was just 2 and 2. We'd stayed where it was all 4 in one room. You know, it's like so we really moved up the food chain.
Now, Budokan was really the big game changer for you. But I understand the concert that we hear live at Budokan isn't actually even in Budokan. It's Osaka. Is that right?
I thought it was, you know, we did a bunch of shows, and they were recorded wherever. Mm-hmm. There was 2 shows at Budokan when we did Ain't That a Shame at that place. One of the shows, a girl jumped off from the balcony onto the stage, grabbed me, and it's like, so that's not the one that you hear, because that one got stopped. It wasn't we stopped the show. We didn't, you know, that didn't happen. But there's that blank space in there. And I think it was Nagoya or something. Some of the stuff – the bass drum track didn't come out. I don't know. You know, I had to go back and look at every one of those things. But, you know, it's live at Budokan. That's where we were for the most part. And so, because we did 2 shows there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I could find out. Does it matter? It's probably not. But they're live tracks from Japan.
Yeah, I've heard that the during the recording of the shows at Budokan, the actual Budokan, the screaming was so loud because the audience was so crazy for the band.
Well, look at me.
Really couldn't hear much. Hey, well, I'm having difficulty controlling myself right now.
I don't doubt it.
Now, was the band aware at the sort of frenzy that was happening in Japan about Cheap Trick around this time? Because it wasn't happening in the States at that time yet. But in Japan, I believe Cheap Trick was having what was essentially Beatlemania-level fandom. Well, was the band aware of that?
Well, we knew that we were popular because what made us get popular in the first place was the first 2 shows of 77 we did with Queen. because Thin Lizzy didn't show up. So the Japanese press was there to see Queen. They liked us. The next night we played in Milwaukee. Same thing. They were Japanese press. They liked us. They asked me, Rick, could you write a story about what it's like touring with Queen? Oh, yeah. Well, see, I've had a whole 29 hours here, so I'm the authority. But I said, you know, I'm full of shit anyhow. So it's like, I said, sure, I'll do it. You know, it's like, and then it was translated, so you couldn't read what I said anyhow. So maybe it was made up. I don't know what. But we start, for them to talk about a band that opens for Queen, along with Queen, it was like, whoa. And we started getting little caricatures and our pictures. See, the first record wasn't even out when we played with them. Mm-hmm. And then later the same year, we played 3 months with Kiss. And the Japanese press was there again mm-hmm. for Kiss. Yeah, we started getting a lot of stuff like that. We started getting fan mail. And then our one song, Clock Strikes 10, was number one. What? You know, it's like, you know, we had zero airplay, especially with that one. It's like, but it was number one there. And then we had another hit. So it was like, we knew we were popular, but there was no talk of doing a live album or whatever. And that record was done. It was the very first Epic Sony record as opposed to Sony and Epic. So it was a new label. Mm-hmm. And the two guys that were our A&R guys or P or whatever went around with us when it was Norio Nanaka. He was like the college rep. Mm-hmm. But we also had John Sykes as one of our college reps. Now he's the head of
guitarist.
No, not that one.
John Sykes.
Oh, okay. He's the head of MTV and Viacom. But he was the college rep. He'd come over to my house and stuff. Mm-hmm. Now he's having sex with Carly Simon or whatever. But I don't know what he did. But so and the other guy was Joe Morita, and his dad was Aseo Morita, the president of Sony. Mm-hmm. And so we were saying, "Hey, go get me a beer, will you?" And I was like, "You're bossing these guys around." but we didn't really kind of realize what it was, who they were or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the last time we were over there, the guy whose idea, Norio Nanaka, to do the college rep, the guy that wanted us to record for the Japanese fans, it was only for the Japanese fans, a little commemorative album or whatever. He was the president of the company mm-hmm. last time we were there. So he had a good idea then. And it's like, he kept going up and it's like, and you know, he's a guy with me. It's like, he's like, hey, Norio, we make fun of each other and laugh, you know, just like you normally do with the president of a company. Yeah.
Sure. Well, especially if you're making lots of money.
I can get away with it, but he was a cool guy. And it's like, it was his idea to do it. So when we're there, you know, we kind of knew we were going to record, but there wasn't all kinds of gear around. We didn't see any like big reel to reels or microphones all over the place. They did it so neat that you just didn't even know you were recording. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the audience was loud, but it's like, it was. When we did "I Want You to Want Me," didn't crying. They did like the echo of the crying. It's like, yeah, we should do that.
So once Budokan started hitting it big, live at Budokan, things really started to change for the band. What was your first sign that you noticed that was like, okay, we're now on this other level?
Well, record company was Lenny Pizzi came to us. We were having a meeting or something, and he gave each of us a $10,000 check. Okay.
we never got just as an appetizer. Was that
an appetizer? That's good.
The fire was catching.
Well, you know, so we were doing with that. I bought my guitar or my car that I still have to this day. Mm-hmm. We were in California and I bought a 1955 Ford Thunderbird, which I still have.
55 Thunderbird. Wow. Yeah.
I saw a car I always wanted, but I never had the money for it. Paid $6,000 for it. It was the first time I had any money I could blow. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't expecting this. So I'll just buy whatever I want.
I wanted that. It's like, I got the donut. I was like, you know, can't wait till, you know, we didn't have expensive houses or like anything.
Cheap Trick, especially in the early days, there's the two guys that look like the typical rock stars.
Oh, yeah, I know. The other guys.
Did the record company in the early days ever try to mold you and Booney?
No. You know, it's like when we did In Color, they didn't even show up with color film. It's true. And it's like, so what? A lot of that stuff wasn't planned out. We always said that it's like, I was like the bands that had, you know, if you have the whole band, it makes your heads look smaller. Mm-hmm. And if you have it flip flop. There's more detail. And that was when there was all albums too.
Oh yeah.
And so like, there's more territory out there to occupy with, engineers' names and where you did this, maybe some lyrics or, mm-hmm. I like that. Now I can't read anything. I got to get a magnifying glass and I still can't read it. So yeah, but we played it up, but at the same time, it's like, it made sense to us. Besides having the two on one side, we also had the gatefold, open it up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get more real estate.
I've always noticed Cheap Trick album covers always have these very carefully orchestrated pictures and imagery and even a bit of a story and a laugh with this. But Budokan has what appears to be a bit of a haphazard photo, the shading and the lighting wasn't great. Did the band have much to do with that package?
Well, our manager at that point, we looked at it and said, this is awful. It looks like a yellow guitar for me. That's actually a blue guitar, but the lights went on it. And he says, don't worry, no one's ever going to see this thing. That was it. Yeah. No one's ever going to see this. So that's a terrible shot. And it's like the Japanese thought it was good enough and we should have just listened to them because we did. We ended up, just using that stuff. It's like we were told, it's just sort of these fans. I mean, you think about it, the Budokan record, and then it was a double. Mm-hmm. It was twice as much music. And we've been known for whatever. We didn't, they didn't want to put that out. It came out 20 years after. I said, there's good marketing.
Yeah.
but the reason we only made half of it, because we were so busy, Bunny and I went to New York and mixed it with Jack Douglas. And then with all the fixing we had to do, because the bass drum would sound like a box or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they had to, it took some time. By that time, we had to get out because we were going on the road again.
Right.
So it's like, let's only do half. That's good enough. That's good enough. It's, mm-hmm. No one's going to see this picture.
Was the EP Found All the Parts?
Yep.
Was that supposed to be a full album that you only had time to do part?
No. No, I think that was, I don't know. I'm not, not sure. I think they wanted to have an EP because they thought that was the 10-inch as opposed to the album thing. It's like, it's going to be the next new thing. It's like, don't worry, these 8-tracks are going to go like hotcakes,
They call them the new disc.
Yeah.
But, Blue Note had been doing 10-inch records 40 years before. There was Found All the Parts, but then at the very end, it looks like there was another 45 stuck in there. Do you remember the conversation around that?
No.
Okay.
I could look it up. I could look it up and see what I could figure out.
That's all right. You know what? Let's talk about the new record. In Another World, the first single came out in 2018.
Yep.
Now, a lot of bands are taking 2020 off because of, obviously COVID. Why two something years for In Another World?
Well, one, Here Comes the Summer, that was just like a single. The album wasn't done, wasn't finished. Okay. So actually when we were doing more songs, so we should put this one on there because who knows it? Some people know it, but not that. It's a good song, put it on. So we're going to add that to what we were doing as we were going along. And we were on Big Machine. So that's, we recorded with Julian, but it wasn't like, we never sat down like, okay, we're going to be in the next month. We're going to be here. We just did it when we could add a song at a time or strip away songs at a time. And we added Give Me Some Truth towards the end. And then we asked Steve Jones because we were having to do Jonesy Jukebox. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he's kind of a gutter player like me, it's like a good rhythm player. He's a great rhythm player with the Sex Pistols. And it's like, you want to do it? Yeah, sure. It's like, we were kind of like on his level, the same kind of, a lot of mistakes are good, it's like, is he not an excellent performance. It was just, he plays like
he's authentic.
He's in the Rolling Stones. He's, it's like, good. Mm-hmm. So it's like, so we asked him to do it, and he was thrilled to do it. And that's how that came about. I mean, we had no plan. It just worked out good. And so we kept doing stuff. And like I told you, I did other records after that and other stuff. And then BMG said they want to sign us. And we were, because of Scott Borchetta at Big Machine, he was such a big fan of ours. But at the same time, it's a country label. It's like, it's almost all country stuff there. It's like, I said, can we leave if we want to say, So just owe us your next everything. No. I'm not sure what it was, but it's like, well, BMG wanted us. And it's like, here's fresh blood. And, you know, it's like, you know, instead of going back to Epic and or whatever and repurposing this old material again and again and again, we wanted to make new records, which we did. So then the pandemic, the record was supposed to be out a year ago, of course. But then the pandemic, it's like, BMG's smarter than a lot of people. So he says, let's not put it out now. It's a bad idea. Okay. And we didn't, you know, great. It, for once, a record company that seemed to know what's going on as opposed to falling into it with us. You know, we're the last to know and they're next to last to know.
Let's talk really quick about Under the Southern Stars. You're coming down in Australia.
On the 9th. We leave the 9th and we get there the 11th.
Okay. And then 2 weeks in a hotel room. Any idea what you're going to do during quarantine?
I said, I hope that you got some good TV. Actually, the last time I was in, one of the times I was in Australia, I watched on this thing called Slingbox. Mm-hmm. I watched Slingbox. I watched my TV in Rockford, Illinois. On there, it was when Obama got elected.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a, so I could watch Slingbox.
I think you better get Slingbox because, yeah, the free-to-air TV that you're going to get in the hotel is pretty woeful. But so you're going to be here for 2 weeks hanging out in a hotel. Then they're going to let you scot-free, and you're going to be doing a tour with Stone Temple Pilots, Bush, Rose Tattoo, Electric Mary, and more. Really one of the first major tours
in the world.
Yeah. In the world, really.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
See, we're number one for something.
Well, and let's also talk April 1st, Cheap Trick Day in Illinois. Do you know how I'm going to celebrate it, Rick?
No idea.
I am going to be listening to Cheap Trick, the complete Budokan concert that I'm ordering off ricknielsen.com.
Wow.
An autographed vinyl version. And I want people to know, if you go to ricknielsen.com in the shop, you can actually get autographed vinyl directly from Rick. He draws a likeness of himself. He'll even personalize it for you. You know, so head up to ricknielsen.com. Have a click of that, and if they have any of the vinyl left, get in quick because it is limited there.
Yeah, I do quite a few of those things. Mm-hmm. It's like if people come to the show or whatever. It's like if people order the Dream Police record, you know, we buy it. It's not like I get it free and then I I get people pay me money for stuff. You know, some of the stuff it costs us a bunch to get it. So then we get it. You know, some of the stuff has been discontinued or whatever. And so then if I do the Dream Police, I sign it, then I open it up and I draw an arrow to my where I'm in the police line and I write me. And then on the back page, I write whatever else.
Cheap Trick has always been such a vinyl-friendly band. Every year there's a Record Store Day release. Vinyl is more than just a format to the band, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like, it's how I grew up, too. You know, it's like there's liner notes, there's letters that the font, I don't need Elder font. To see, you know, it's already got adult-sized font, and you read the information and who's the engineer and where it was recorded, what city, and they occasionally spell things wrong, and I complain about it. But if you can spell my name any way you want on a check, but otherwise, you know, it's like, you can call me whatever you want. But my name is misspelled so much. It's like I always like to have it right because once it's wrong, then that gets more people think it's that way.
Yeah.
Because journalists would never screw up, or the record company.
Getting the I and the E flipped Son or Sen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had that my whole life. So, like I said, on a check, you can call me Mr. Mickelsplix. It's the guy with Superman.
All right. Thanks again, Rick, for stopping by the Vinyl Guide. Again, everyone, check out Cheap Trick if you're in Australia under the southernstars.com.au. Our first live music festival since this damn pandemic began. Really looking forward to this. And not only the guys from Cheap Trick, but Bush, Stone Temple Pilots, they're all going under the strict Australian quarantine just to bring live music back to Australia. So
yes,
let's celebrate that under the southernstars.com.au. Pick up the new Cheap Trick In Another World, April 9th. And everyone, have a great Cheap Trick Day, April 1st. By the way, Rick, am I the first to wish you a happy Cheap Trick Day?
Yeah, well, yeah, this year.
Yes.
Yeah, we started that I think it was 2007. So it's like, it's been active for 14 years, something like that.
That's amazing. And it's actually part of the state legislature in the state of Illinois.
Yeah, I was asked about that. I said, well, we'd like to do commemorate. Because you think about it, in Illinois, we're one of the few people that have brought money from Japan to as opposed to shipping it out. That's one. I said, two, it's like, what day would you? Well, let's see. My birthday, December 22nd, and Halloween, and how about April Fool's Day? I said, first, I said, people, either they believe it or they don't. And it's like, I said, that's perfect. So that's how that was picked.
All right. Well, God bless you, Rick. We will see you in Australia in April. Travel safe. Continue to mask up, and looking forward to seeing them shows under the southernstars.com.au.
Sounds good.
All right, there we have it. Mr. Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, the king of collectors. And man, amazing stories. And I get the feeling we're only scratching the surface here. And by the way, if you enjoyed this interview, there's more available on our Patreon page at patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there now, sign up. You get all sorts of exclusive content, including an extended interview with Rick, as well as the video of our interview with Rick. And there's other visuals and stuff that we've thrown in there too. Some fun for our patreon.com/vinylguide community. Please join us up there, help support the show, get the exclusive content, and hear and see all the extras. And just a quick reminder to you Australians, don't forget, underthesouthernstars.com.au, the festival featuring Cheap Trick, Bush, Stone Temple Pilots, Rose Tattoo, Electric Mary, and likely others, going up and down the eastern side of Australia from the end of April towards the end of May. Again, it's amazing. All these artists are coming down under, and they're going to be quarantining in hotel rooms for multiple weeks just to bring the music to you. Make sure to pick up your ticket at underthesouthernstars.com.au. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Tweet them out on Twitter. Share them on Facebook, Instagram, all of the socials. That is a huge help. Leave us positive reviews on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever you get these podcasts. And also, don't forget to tell your friends about The Vinyl Guide, especially your record nerd friends or the ones you like to talk about with music. That's always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we do, get out there and buy some records. Thanks, everyone. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.